Hello from Gilbert and Tobin. I'm Moya Dodd.
And I'm Matt Rubenstein, and this is The Competitive Edge, what you need to know about competition law in Australia and around the Rotary world.
Today, dial M for merger. Partners Elizabeth Avery and Louise Klamke join us for a deep dive into Australia's new merger approval framework, which was just announced by the Treasurer and is scheduled to come into effect on New Year's Day 2026.
Anytime you're in a global transaction, you're departing from what is standard and introducing some bespoke notification requirement, particularly given Australia's a smaller jurisdiction, that creates some consternation.
I think that the other big ticket item to consult on is the thresholds and how they will work and the extent to which that can be predictable and consistent with regimes in other jurisdictions would also be valued, I think, by people doing global transactions.
But first, Matt, dial M for merger is obviously the same joke as merger on the dance floor a few episodes ago. Is there anything we need to know about Dial M for Murder, the Alfred Hitchcock movie from 1954?
Well, it was Hitchcock's only 3D film, and everyone hated it in that format and demanded that they show it in 2D, or flat, as they call it. I actually saw it once in 3D, many years later, at the Capri Cinema in Adelaide, after the organ guy had disappeared back into the floor. There's a giant phone that comes out of the screen right at you. It's pretty impressive.
Oh, telco angle. We've spoken about Pennsylvania 65000 and Butterfield 8, which were based off the old telephone exchange prefixes. But what would dialing M ever connect you to?
Well, nothing really. Even in the 1950s, they had more phone numbers than that. You could dial O for operator, zero, of course. So it's probably a play on that.
Probably. But try it out. Dial M. You might get me.
Or me.
How lucky. So what's been happening around the grounds?
Well, of course, we now know that Treasurer Jim Chalmers has announced what he called the biggest reform to Australia's merger settings in almost 50 years, and it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah, almost 50 years ago is when we got the Trade Practices Act, 1974, right?
That's right. The inaugural chair of the Trade Practices Commission back then was Ron Bannerman, great superhero name, and the Treasurer took to the annual Bannerman competition lecture to talk about the government's proposal.
Because the new reforms will make our approval regime faster and stronger and simpler, and more targeted and more transparent. It will be faster because most will now be approved within 30 working days, where the ACCC is satisfied a merger poses no threat to competition. It will be stronger because we are legislating a mandatory notification system and empowering the ACCC as the single decision maker on all mergers. The new regime will be simpler because we are reducing three streams to a single streamlined path to approval that removes duplication and standardises notification requirements for all mergers.
Well, it was very courageous for the Treasurer. He really put a lot of Matilda's fans in a bind, though. Did he have to go head-to-head with the live broadcast of the match against Mexico?
He must really believe in competition if he's going to go head-to-head with the Matildas.
No kidding. I mean, I'm still waiting on the ratings figures, but early counting suggests that the front-loaded information requirements of the Treasurer's proposals are really the high press of competition policy. And actually, that was pretty well dealt with by Caitlin Ford and Hayley Rasso. 2-0 win. Well done, Matildas.
Well done, Matildas. As if that wasn't enough, at the same time, Treasury released its paper called Merger Reform, a Faster, Stronger and Simpler System for a More Competitive Economy.
Faster, stronger, simpler? Must be an Olympic year. Who came up with that? Was it Spencer Webber Waller?
A lot of us in the office were reminded of Daft Punk's Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger.
Well, there's always faster, higher, stronger together from the Olympics. But hey, the over 40 season's just started, so I'm probably in the older, fatter, slower lane, unfortunately.
Well, I thought of Radiohead's Fitter, Happier, More Productive, which is definitely one for the over 40s.
Oh, yeah. Well, that'd be a good name for a Productivity Commission report, too.
Looking forward to that one. Now, G&T partners Simon Mose and Andrew Lowe have a short video reaction to the changes, which we'll link to in the show notes. And the team have put together a terrific update with all the details, which we'll share as well.
And that's before we even get to our exclusive interview with partners Elizabeth Avery and Louise Klamke.
It is. But just to set the scene, at the moment in Australia, we have an informal merger clearance process and a formal merger authorisation process, plus the ability for parties to go to court to get a declaration that their merger won't lessen competition.
And those are all voluntary processes for the merger parties. They don't have to notify anyone, although they usually do. And if the ACCC wants to stop a merger, it has to take the parties to court for an injunction.
They do. But as the Treasurer said, from 2026, there'll just be the one process, where all mergers that meet certain turnover or market share thresholds will have to be notified to the ACCC, and they can't go ahead unless that process has been completed in their favour.
So this is totally an administrative review model.
That's right. So Treasury has helpfully illustrated that process through a kind of highway diagram with on-ramps and off-ramps, which kind of looks like the new Rozelle Interchange, recently described by local residents as creating a kind of squid game.
You know, they just need to add a little cartoon Rebel Wilson, that famous Rozelle Interchange hater, applying for a clearance for her merger.
I mean, that could even be her in the picture. They're engaging in informal pre-notification discussions with the ACCC. After that, she's going to file her paperwork, and then she'll be in phase one, where there's an exit at 15 days if the ACCC can see that the merger won't raise any issues and is suitable for fast-track approval.
So this is like her getting on that free bit of the motorway that skips a couple of traffic lights and merge points, and then whoosh, she's out of the tunnel in 15 days. And this will replace the informal pre-assessment process that we have at the moment.
Pretty much. If she misses that exit, there's another one at 30 days.
Ooh, rapid.
Not bad. Where the ACCC has had a decent look at the merger, it's asked for submissions, but it can't see any real chance of a substantial lessening of competition.
So compared to the current informal process, this is quite an accelerated timetable. But the ACCC can hit the brakes if it needs to wait for further information or negotiate remedies.
It can. And at the end of phase one, if it's not sure about the merger, it'll activate like a ramp meter where it identifies any issues that could or are likely to raise competition concerns in any market.
Right. So currently the ACCC gives a statement of issues with red or orange lights, depending on how concerned they are. So I think this metaphor is just about holding up.
And we're nearly there. Now, this will be the start of a phase two in-depth review, and that'll go for 90 days.
And then, if the ACCC doesn't think that the merger will substantially lessen competition, it'll give Rebel the green light and she's off up the highway to Byron Bay or wherever.
That's right. If they don't give her the green light, then there's a bit of a crossroads.
Even though motorways don't usually have crossroads?
Yeah, this one does. So she can either argue that the merger has public benefits that would outweigh the anti-competitive detriments identified by the ACCC, or she can apply to the Australian Competition Tribunal for a limited merits review of the ACCC's decision.
And that's the same kind of role the tribunal plays at the moment for merger authorisations.
Yeah, so it'll focus on the material that was before the ACCC, though it can seek some clarifying information and allow new information that didn't exist when the ACCC made its decision, just like now. And Simon Mose has spoken about the limits of that process before, and here's what he says now.
The complication with the current merger review process before the tribunal is that it operates only as a limited merits review. So it's not a full drains up testing of the evidence the ACCC had before it, but very much a limited review on the papers based on what evidence or material was originally before the commission. That is, has been proven to be over the last 12 or 18 months, a very constrained process, and parties are very limited in terms of what material they can bring on at that second phase to test and challenge the findings of the commission. So overall, the package involves a much more administrative discretionary process. It will almost certainly be less transparent than the federal court, and it has quite constrained review rights with, I think it's fair to say, a shift away from evidence and more toward economic analysis and theories of harm.
So what if Rebel Wilson applies to the tribunal, but then she talks to Simon Mose and decides she wants to run a public benefits argument?
Well, then she'll have to back up out of the tribunal tunnel, like a few people did when that Rozelle Interchange first opened.
Tricky.
And then run the public benefit argument with the ACCC. And if they say no, she'll have to sort of loop back onto the motorway towards the tribunal in a way that looks pretty dangerous in the illustration, I have to say.
And this will be the only way to go from the first day of 2026. There's no rat run through the federal court?
Only on a judicial review basis, which will be very limited. So it's the ACCC's way or the highway, if that's not too confusing.
We might just have crashed the metaphor. So was there anything the ACCC asked for that they didn't get?
There were two main things. They'd asked for a call-in power so that if a merger didn't meet any of the thresholds, they could still bring it into the process if they were interested for other reasons. But they didn't get that. And they'd ask for the onus of proof to be reversed so they'd only clear a merger if they were satisfied that it wouldn't lessen competition, but they didn't get that one either. So they'll have to clear a merger unless they're satisfied that it will substantially lessen competition.
Is that going to make a big difference when the ACCC still gets to decide whether it's satisfied or not?
It'll probably make the most difference where the evidence is really incomplete or ambiguous, and that might include the counterfactual scenario, unless the ACCC moves away from that approach, which you'd think they'd quite like to do.
And even though it's the ACCC's decision, they know it might be reviewed by the tribunal and they're going to want to get it right.
They will. And there'll be new guidelines coming out, of course, and the ACCC will need to publish reasons for every decision they make, with more detailed reasons for the more complex cases. So there should be a build-up of precedent developing, even if it doesn't have the same binding power as court precedent would, and it may not have the same level of detail either.
And there's a lot of consultation still to come around the thresholds, the final timelines, the fees, procedural fairness safeguards, and possible penalties. And there'll be an exposure draft of the legislation sometime this year.
Yeah, so still a fair bit to work out, but it looks like the big picture is pretty much there.
And we'll hear more about that from Elizabeth and Louise in a few minutes. Is there anything else going on?
Well, there's still a lot going on with groceries and supermarkets. So Green Senator Nick McKim has introduced a bill that would give the ACCC power to seek orders from the court to reduce the market power or market share of a business that was found to have misused its market power. And this is the Competition and Consumer Amendment Divestiture Powers Bill of 2024. And that would apply to any industry, but unsurprisingly, Senator McKim has focused on groceries and supermarkets as the main example of a sector where the powers would be used. And the main kind of order would be the forced sale of assets, like individual stores or groups of stores, but there may be other orders that could have those purposes as well, like divesting home brand products.
So this came up about a month ago, and the Prime Minister said that he wouldn't introduce a divestiture power because, quote, we're not the old Soviet Union, unquote. Are they the new Soviet Union, Matt?
I hadn't heard that. But, I mean, did the old Soviet Union order divestitures, or did it just nationalise everything?
Yeah, I think it was more the ex-Soviet Union that started divesting things, wasn't it?
I think so. And now everyone's divesting their Russian assets, or at least saying that they are.
And the Greens and the Nationals have pointed out that a lot of countries do have divestiture powers. But have those countries been using those powers to deal with misuse of market power or abuse of dominance?
Well, not lately. I mean, people talk about the famous breakup of AT&T, but that case was filed 50 years ago.
Yeah, and in 2000, there was Microsoft getting ordered to separate its operating system from its software development, like Internet Explorer, right?
Yeah, but that order was eventually overturned. There have been a few divestitures over cartel conduct and a lot over mergers, of course, but not so much for misuse of market power.
And we've had the Hilmer Review, the Dawson Review, and the Harper Review all consider a divestiture power, but they all rejected it as unnecessary and actually quite difficult to put into practice without messing everything up. Even though, I've got to say, there's a whole generation of Matildas fans now who think that the Harper Review was about Katrina Gorry's childcare arrangements.
And ACCC Chair Gina Cass-Gottlieb, as well as promoting better childcare policies, has said that a divestiture power isn't a priority for them right now. They're more focused on the merger reforms and unfair trading practices. Though in time, she says, it would be a useful addition to the toolkit.
And Gina mentioned the importance of the unfair trading practices prohibition at the Bannerman lecture too. So with that, and debating the finer details of the merger proposals, sounds like divestiture is on the back burner for them.
It does for now. In the meantime, Craig Emerson has said, in the interim report of his review of the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct, that there's no need for divestiture powers.
Why, Allah, why not?
Glad you asked. He says that forced divestiture of individual stores could end up increasing market concentration if another chain were to buy those stores, and store closures if nobody else wanted them.
He also says that competition is best supported by the existing competition and consumer laws, with some changes to planning and zoning laws and changes to the code of conduct.
Right, and importantly, he's recommending that the code of conduct be fully mandatory and also backed up by penalties for contraventions.
Are they the triple threat penalties?
They're actually the old triple threat penalties. That's the greater of $10 million, three times the benefit obtained, or 10% of annual turnover. And those have applied to the franchising code of conduct since 2022. Of course, they're now a fair bit lower than the maximum penalties that apply to other parts of the competition and consumer law.
Well, you could argue that contravening a code of conduct is less serious than breaking an actual law, but maybe not now that we're all ex ante all the time. Time for one more?
Well, we have a bit more information about the ACCC's application for leave to appeal to the High Court in the CFMEU case, thanks to our friends at MLEX.
This is after the full federal court decided that the CFMEU's threat to shut down the South Point worksite didn't result in a meeting of the minds and wasn't even an attempt to induce one.
That's right. And the ACCC is arguing that was the wrong decision, that the overall course of conduct that included the CFMEU's threat and Hutchies complying with their demands was enough, even without any express acknowledgement by Hutchies.
Actions speak louder than words.
Or at least as loud. The ACCC says this wasn't parallel conduct, it was acquiescent conduct, and that that's different, that does involve a meeting of the minds. And they cite the recent BlueScope decision in support, though that decision has also been appealed to the full federal court.
So the old argument about what's a meeting of the minds and an arrangement or understanding isn't settled yet, even after all this time.
Yeah, it looked like the attempt to induce option might be a bit of a shortcut, but even that isn't so simple, it turns out.
And there's more detail about all of this in the latest edition of The Rap Sheet, which is our team's quarterly roundup of competition and consumer litigation. We'll link to it in the show notes.
We will. I have to say, we got a bit confused last time about the CFMEU and the CFMMEU and the CFMEU again.
We said that the Maritime Union had split off with the Energy Division to leave the Construction, Forestry and Maritime Employees Union, which doesn't make any sense.
No sense at all. It was, of course, the Mining Division that split off.
Can you imagine a Maritime and Energy Union, Matt? What would they have in common?
I mean, wave power or nuclear submarines? I don't know.
Carbon sequestration through seaweed farms? I know there's a Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers and Grain Millers Union in North America.
Sounds like a party. And Homer Simpson famously belongs to the International Brotherhood of Jazz Dancers, Pastry Chefs and Nuclear Technicians, as we learned in Last Exit to Springfield, another Season 4 classic.
Season 4, is there anything it can't do?
Also Season 4.
I also see Denmark has an association of lawyers and economists, which maybe wouldn't be so bad.
No, we love economists.
So we must have got a ton of emails, did we, complaining that we had the wrong M?
Yeah, I was surprised at how many union officials and members we had in the audience. Shop stewards, clerks of the chapel, you name it.
You never know who's listening. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on the special leaves to see how the ACCC goes with the High Court.
We will.
Well, in the meantime, partners Elizabeth Avery and Louise Klemke have been watching the merger developments from the ABA's antitrust spring meeting in Washington, D.C., and they're back to tell us more about the proposals and how they place us in an international context.
Yeah, and they had a lot to say about what we know about the new framework and also what we still have to work out. Let's take a listen. I'm here today with partners Elizabeth Avery and Louise Klemke. Elizabeth and Louise, welcome back to The Competitive Edge.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
So while the Treasurer was announcing the new merger framework in Sydney and the Matildas were playing Mexico in San Antonio, you were both in Washington, D.C. for the ABA's antitrust spring meeting. How was the meeting this year?
It was great. You can't have a better event when you have over 4,000 antitrust lawyers gathered in the one place. There's lots to talk about globally, lots happening on the antitrust front. And of course, it was spring and the cherry blossoms were out. But we'll get into the substance of the meeting in another podcast.
So we've given a rough outline of the new merger approval process with a bit of help from Revel Wilson. And we might start by asking, did either the new Australian framework or the Matildas 2-0 victory over Mexico get much attention from our international colleagues?
As disappointing as it might be for Moya, I'm afraid the new merger framework got a lot more attention than the Matildas.
And what was their view about the changes and what they might mean? I guess including for international merger parties and their in-house counsel and external lawyers.
Obviously, it's early days because while a lot of work has gone into coming up with this paper and there's been a lot of debate so far, the devil is still in the detail. So there's a lot of questions they have about detail that's simply not known yet. But I think in general, they did not react adversely and indeed some welcomed the introduction of a mandatory and suspensory regime, provided the thresholds are sensible. That provides more certainty as to when they need to advise their clients that a notification in Australia is really not optional. There was some concern about a market share-based default threshold, what that meant, because, of course, market shares can be difficult to obtain, particularly in a global industry where you have lack of visibility into Australia and market share data is hard to come by, how on earth that was going to work in practice and whether that turned into a de facto call-in power, that was of concern to them. But the idea of a compulsory and mandatory regime was not unwelcome. Some of the other aspects were.
I think that the things that people were surprised or concerned about were probably the same sorts of things that we were surprised about. So one question that came up was about the relationship between the power to look at roll-up transactions and the notification thresholds. So the framework is contemplating the ability for the ACCC to assess creeping acquisitions in a way they haven't been able to in the past and to take into consideration successive acquisitions over a three-year period in the SLC test. And you can see how that would work. That would be subject to the same kind of tests that you would currently apply to a single transaction, just over a series of transactions. But the inclusion of that as part of the look back period in the threshold analysis was confusing, and people wondered how, as a practical matter, you would even keep track of that. Would you be keeping an Excel spreadsheet with the value and date of each of your acquisitions and then wait for it to tick over into the new year before you acquired another one? Does there have to be some kind of parameter around that in terms of it being in the same product market? That would make a lot more sense from our perspective, I think, in terms of aligning with the purpose of capturing those creeping acquisitions that otherwise would have an SLC effect.
I agree with that. It's also quite novel as compared to other regimes around the world. No one else has this creeping acquisitions look back provision. And so anytime you're in a global transaction, you're departing from what is standard and introducing some bespoke notification requirement, particularly given Australia's a smaller jurisdiction, that creates some consternation.
And it may be the case that further consultations required on this, particularly as it relates to the thresholds. This was not something that was promulgated in the previous Treasury paper or in the ACCC's proposals. So I think that having a focus on that amongst the other consultation pieces in the coming months is going to be important. The other things that sort of surprised us were the size of the filing fees. While it makes sense to have a filing fee that is, the Treasurer said, based on cost recovery associated with the process, fees of $50,000 to $100,000 are far and away higher than is currently the case for the merger authorisation process and will make a really significant impact for most transactions.
And if you assume that the ACCC is reviewing 325 transactions a year, which is what it did last year or thereabouts, and you're assuming 50,000 per transaction, that's over 16 million. That's a lot of revenue, which is perhaps helpful for the ACCC's resourcing, but you kind of wonder whether that's absolutely necessary for cost recovery.
One thing that we were interested to see that was a bit of a surprise, in a good way, was the safe harbour from a FIRB perspective. So it's proposed that if a transaction does not trigger the thresholds wherever they're set, but does require FIRB approval, then FIRB will not need to consult with the ACCC for the transactions that fall within that bucket. So that potentially cuts out a lot of unnecessary ACCC review and engagement of transactions requiring FIRB, which is currently taking place. And that was definitely of positive interest to a lot of the international firms we spoke to as well.
The other thing I think that was a pleasant surprise was the timeline, which provides for a quicker review of simpler transactions. We had understood that they would provide a fast track process, but 30 days, 30 working days is a welcome development to provide such certainty. And I think it is probably quicker than the ACCC's current review period for phase one transactions, for example. We'll see whether the pre-notification period elongates that actual review time. In the US, it is really possible to file and then get a decision within 30 days in the vast majority of cases as to whether you clear or go into phase two. But in Europe, of course, there is some very lengthy pre-notification consultation period, which really means that any concept there's a 30-day review period is somewhat artificial. I would hope that this proposed timeline moves us closer to the US certainty of being able to get a decision in those first 30 days rather than have that pre-merger consultation period significantly elongated. But we'll have to wait and see. As I mentioned before, the devil will be in the detail.
So all these merger changes are focused on preventing markets from getting any more concentrated. But at the same time, the Greens, the Nationals, and also former ACCC Chair Alan Fells have said that we should be actively reducing concentration by breaking up companies that have misused their market power. What do you think about these sort of very structural views of competition and the solutions that have been proposed?
I think that they're based on a particular school of thought, which isn't necessarily consistent with an economy that is a small economy that needs to be efficient and competing very hard on a world stage, basically suggests that big is bad. Now, big in Australia is really small compared to the rest of the world. And I don't think we should be preventing efficiencies that mean that we're able to compete more aggressively with our international competitors. It's an unwelcome development, and I'm not in favour of a cottage industry economy.
While those calls for breaking up large companies appear to be fanciful, and certainly Anthony Albanese has made it clear that we don't want to be like the old Soviet Union and encourage these kind of proposals, there is an element of this big is bad theory that has crept into the framework that's proposed. So in addition to the retention of the SLC test for an assessment of mergers, the ACCC will also be able to test against a criteria of whether the transaction creates, strengthens, or entrenches a position of substantial market power. And in inviting the application of that test, it's removed from the market-based assessment that a substantial lessening of competition is. So it potentially allows them to bring in conglomerate effects, which we know that they're keen on, and the concept of ecosystem impact. But there's a real question around where the constraints on that test will lie. And I do think it is veering towards that if you are at a certain size, any transaction that you do may create, strengthen, or entrench a position of substantial market power.
And if it's divorced from an SLC test, it does really mean that big is bad theory is going to be legislated. I think that is a problem because, of course, the regulator and the courts, or the tribunal, as the case may be, are going to have to interpret it to mean something different to the SLC test, which means that they are going to have to give credence to it in a way that even if there is no substantial lessening of competition, if you are big and this entrenches your market power, and that means something more than creating any ability to substantial lessening of competition, the transaction could be prohibited.
Treasury will continue to consult on things like the nature of the thresholds, the timelines and fees that will apply, and of course the legislation itself, which we'll see an exposure draft of in time. What do you think are the most important things to get right during this next phase?
One thing I think is really important to get right is the procedural safeguards that will apply in a limited merits review environment. And that means not a de novo review or a complete rehearing, but what it actually means to have a limited merits review can vary from absolutely nothing can be considered that wasn't considered below to, well, there was some evidence that wasn't provided to the parties that they were unable to respond to below, or some inquiries weren't made of a third party below that have significant bearing on the matter and should be made. There is some debate as to precisely what limited merits review means, and I think it will be important to have in place the right procedural safeguards to make sure that there is real accountability. The other thing I think is important to get right in that context is the ability to supplement the record on a case-by-case basis. Now, I know the ACCC is concerned about parties holding back evidence in that first phase of review, but what often happens is issues emerge over time and you can't tell until third parties have put on evidence what the issues are. So to upfront have to front load your initial application with every witness state, every expert report that you may need if you go on appeal to the tribunal would be extremely costly and time consuming, not only for the parties, but also for the ACCC reviewing the transaction. So there does need to be, I think, some ability as the process goes on to right size your application for the matter as it evolves. That may mean that's an ability once the ACCC comes back to you with a preliminary statement of views to supplement the record at that point with anything before they make their final decision so that parties have that fair ability and don't have to dump huge amounts of information on the ACCC that are unnecessary and irrelevant to their decision.
I think that the other big ticket item to consult on is the thresholds and how they will work, and to test the consequences of that look back aspect of the thresholds. That was certainly a thing that exercised the minds of the international participants that we spoke to over the last week, and the extent to which that can be predictable and consistent with regimes in other jurisdictions would also be valued, I think, by people doing global transactions.
I agree with that, and particularly how realistic the market share thresholds are as an alternative threshold. They're going to be particularly difficult to implement in practice, I think.
One other aspect that seems to be missing from the thresholds is an explicit nexus to Australia. Obviously, when you're doing your competition assessment, an SLC analysis requires there to be an effect in a market in Australia or a global market that impacts Australia. So you have your nexus there. But when it comes to the thresholds in terms of transaction value or turnover, it's not clear what that nexus requirement will be. And there is a risk then that it could be used to call in transactions that don't really affect Australia. That may well be the intention, particularly in, say, the tech industry, where the ACCC has expressed a desire to review transactions in particular. But if there are no Australian users or very few Australian users, it's unclear how those thresholds will apply.
You'd have to say that the ACCC has been pretty successful in reshaping the competition and consumer law over the last few years. What do you think is driving this alignment and how far do you think it can go?
We saw this at the spring meeting between all regulators around the world. There is definitely a zeitgeist of using antitrust law or looking to antitrust law to address all sorts of social and political concerns that I guess the government feels unable to address in other ways. And the ACCC is an extremely competent regulator staffed by very competent practitioners. And I think our government is also looking increasingly to Chair Cascott Lieb and her team to investigate and come up with solutions to resolve difficult problems that aren't really in the cradle of traditional antitrust. So the issues we're seeing around cost of living and inflation, the government is looking to the ACCC with supermarket inquiries, with gas pricing, childcare, a whole lot of issues and inquiries where the government is asking the ACCC to step up and play a larger role. And of course, the ACCC welcomes the ability to advance their objective, which is to protect the welfare of all Australians. And even though they're not traditional competition concerns, they do fall broadly within that objective.
Well, Elizabeth and Louise, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your views and reporting back from the Antitrust Spring Meeting.
Pleasure, Matt. Thank you.
What a great interview, and interesting to hear how our colleagues overseas are reacting to the news.
I guess if you're used to dealing with MJ mergers all over the world, this doesn't seem quite as significant as it does here.
Yeah, we've definitely ended up with elements that are familiar from other jurisdictions. And I'm sure the ACCC would say that they've taken the best aspects of each regime.
But I've also just seen Simon Moses told Capital Brief that he's worried we might have picked the worst aspects of the European and Australian systems, and that the new system may be less transparent than the current merger authorisation and the federal court approaches.
Yeah, and partner Jeremy Joyce says something similar in the AFR. It may well be more transparent than the current informal clearance process overall, but that's not saying much.
It's not. But before we go, the crystal ball's looking a bit worse for wear these days. Can you see anything in there?
Well, there's one thing that's still not entirely clear about the merger proposals, and that's to do with the merger test that the ACCC and the tribunal will apply.
The test is still whether there's likely to be a substantial lessening of competition, right? They haven't changed the meaning of likely, have they?
They haven't done that, but they do now seem to be saying that any acquisition that creates, strengthens, or entrenches substantial market power will effectively be deemed to substantially lessen competition.
So we thought maybe there'd be a rebuttable presumption that creating or strengthening substantial market power would be strong evidence for a substantial lessening of competition, like it is in Europe. But this presumption sounds like it might be an irrebuttable one.
Sounds irrebuttable. Here's what the Treasurer said.
It will be more targeted because mergers that create, strengthen, or entrench substantial market power will be identified and stopped, while those consistent with our national economic interest will be fast-tracked.
And here's ACCC Chair Gina Cascott-Lieb.
The test is a test that is understood across this legal community, because it is a substantial lessening of competition test, but which does make clear that the creation, strengthening, or entrenchment of a position of substantial market power is treated as a substantial lessening of competition. The economists here, I think, would say that's always been the case, but we do see the importance of that being expressed directly in the law.
Well, it's true that there's a close relationship between increasing market power and lessening competition,
That is true, but I think that economists might still want to focus on substantial or material impacts on market power, which was once the ACCC's position. Otherwise, quite a marginal increase in market power could be enough to sink your merger, even if you could show that it would only lessen competition to an insubstantial extent.
Like if it was an acquisition of a very small company, or there was a very small likelihood that it would have much of an impact on the market?
Yeah, and those are the kind of acquisitions that a lot of regulators are worried about, especially when you look backwards at some of the mergers that have gone through. But they're also the kind of acquisitions that startups are hoping to attract when they get into a market in the first place.
Indeed. Well, this might come down to the exact wording of the new merger legislation.
It might, and we should see an exposure draft this year, as we said.
And the prediction is?
Well, there are still plenty of arguments to be had before 2026.
Gosh, that's a relief. Remember, you can find relevant links in the show notes and email us at edge@gtlaw.com.au.
And we've got some great guests still to come, including Romany Webb from Columbia University on regulating carbon capture and removal, and Special Counsel Amelia McKellar with the latest on everyone's favourite part of the Australian consumer law, the consumer guarantees. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, leave us a review, and tell your friends.
Till next time, this was The Competitive Edge with Gilbert and Tobin. Harder, better, faster, stronger.